Hello and welcome to a Wednesday on The Conversation, and no doubt a Wednesday where you are too. Now, the debate over healthcare costs has sucked a lot of air out of other health-related issues, including an understanding of just how healthy Americans are relative to where they live. Today, a national group released its annual rankings of counties within each state. In Hawaii, between last year and this year, Kauai County switched places with Honolulu to take the top spot. Maui County remained at third, and Hawaii County is at the bottom of the list. We called Julie Willems-Van Dyke, the director of the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps Group, and I asked her what larger national trends she saw this year.
As we looked at the data that compiles the county health rankings and looked at it across the nation, we did see some alarming trends in premature death this year, Beth Ann. After years of seeing decreasing rates of premature death, beginning in 2012, we started to see it inch up and then saw a fairly significant rise from 2014 to 2015. What we found was 85% of what contributed to that increase in premature death from 2014 to 2015 was happening in the lives of people in the prime of their lives, people 15 to 44 years of age. And that was very disconcerting to us. In the older group, the 25 to 44-year-old group, it was an alarming increase in drug overdose deaths. And in the younger group, the 15 to 24-year-old group, it was a combination. There were some drug overdose deaths, but also motor vehicle crashes and homicides and suicides. So a combination of a variety of injuries, all of which are things that we can prevent. And these are things that community members can come together to take action on to change the conditions that lead to those injuries.
What did you see happening in the communities where this wasn't happening? What do they have in place, perhaps, that the rest of the communities that are dealing with this don't?
There's a variety of things that community members can come together and do. So we know that if we can prevent childhood exposure to trauma, that's important. And there's programs such as the nurse home visitation program that communities can deploy to support families. We know if we create safe space for youth and young adults in schools where they feel like they're supported by adults, and if there's bullying, that people deal with issues like that, that children will be better supported. We know that if kids are feeling like school isn't doing it for them, that there might be alternative ways of providing education, and we've seen a number of communities really look at truancy and look at kids early when they're disconnecting from school and finding really great alternative ways of helping support them in education.
It's interesting that you mentioned trauma. We've just had an annual International Trauma Convention in Hawaii, and at that conference, one of the things that has come out over the last couple of years, and certainly this year too, is that we look at trauma very differently now than we did 5 or 10 years ago, and actually weight that in how a child is experiencing life and what a child might need to be able to deal with it successfully.
Well, that's fabulous to hear, because that is exactly the kind of action that we need people in communities and states like yours to take, and to raise that kind of awareness with school teachers, with law enforcement, with people who interact with young people. We have a great example from our friends in the Menominee Nation, a Native American tribe in Wisconsin, where they were seeing very low rates of graduation, and they really did, it sounds like what you guys are doing, hone in on trauma and provide much stronger social-emotional support at school, including like a meditation room for when children are acting out. And with that kind of strong support in their school system and strong adult mentoring, they've seen their graduation rate rise from 60% to 92% in a few short years.
Looking at Hawaii and how Hawaii had some pretty good rankings there, given some of the issues that we've talked about that other places are dealing with, how is Hawaii compared to other states across the nation, other counties across the nation?
So you guys are doing quite well. When I look at your premature death rate from both your top-ranked county, Kauai, and your lower-ranked county, Hawaii, you're doing a really good job of attending to premature death. And that's because many of the elements that lead to that, like health behaviors and educational rates and employment, are all things that seem to be going fairly well in Hawaii.
In looking at the counties from Kauai all the way to Hawaii, part of the issue seems to be accessibility to medical care, and some of that obviously plays into length of life and quality of life. Even though we've done very well in all of that, how do we begin to change some of these factors where we have situations here, being an island state, that other states just don't have?
Well, I think this is the beauty of the county health rankings, is because what we've done here is provide you with information that members of your islands can go right to countyhealthrankings.org and look at the data themselves and see, here's what's most important to our community, here's where we're doing really well, here's where we have some challenges, and can think about what is the best local solution for us. We also at countyhealthrankings.org have a number of resources. We have a What Works for Health, which is a database of solutions for how people might address these issues. And again, there's a whole variety of things that people can look at. And we know one size doesn't fit all. And so people can look to those solutions and say, what would work best here in Hawaii or Oahu may not work as the same way if you're on the mainland?
As you look toward next year's rankings, will all of these same categories remain the same, or is there anything you think needs to be added that we should be looking at a little differently as we move into the future?
We have worked very hard to keep the same measures in place for our health outcomes measure, because that's the place where we can look at long-term trends. And we've also provided trend data, for example, for premature death, so people can see how they've been doing over the last decade and moving forward. When we look at the health factors measures, that's a place we regularly do update and add new measures, because we're always learning more about what contributes to health, and we want to empower local residents with the best information. So, for example, this year, that measure of disconnected youth, or youth aged 16 to 24 who are not in school and not employed, is a new measure we've added this year to help people understand that population in their community and think about where they can take action.
What about within clinical care? Because we know very clearly that we are still looking at what that care may mean and what may happen to bring that care, even though Obamacare will be continuing along for the foreseeable future. But what happens with Medicaid? What happens with access to care?
Yeah, we include a measure of the percent of the population that is uninsured, which, again, of course, Hawaii has done very well with, because you've got a long history of attending to that issue. And so we'll continue to look for measures there. We'll say one thing that does limit us sometimes is we have to look at measures that are available at the county level across the nation. And so sometimes that can be challenging in terms of the clinical care measures. But we have added measures, for example, about access to dental care and access to mental health care in response to users of the data saying this would be important information for us to have.
I want to thank you very much for the time.
Thank you very much.
Julie Williams Van Dyke is the director of the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps, a collaboration of the University of Wisconsin's Population Health Institute and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Its rankings are out today.
This Week in This American Life, Rhea discovers in her mid-20s that her mom, who she knew as a homemaker and a mom, used to run guns for a guerrilla organization while pretending to be on a honeymoon.
So what was your first day as a newlywed spy in Southern Africa like?
Well, we weren't spies. We were undercover agents.
That's this week.
Here, This American Life, Saturday at 1 p.m.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, looking at the Hawaii Potters Guild's Empty Bowls project. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about Hawaii's only native land mammal, a creature about which all too little is known. It has wings, catches its dinner with acrobatic aerial maneuvers, and it feeds on a diet of insects at twilight, which is the most likely time to get a look at it. It's not easy to do because, unfortunately, like so many native species, it's listed as federally endangered. Its English and Hawaiian names come from its appearance. Its English name is based on its fur, which is brown but frosted white on its back. Its Hawaiian name means half leaf because the outline of its body looks like a half of a taro leaf. And today we're looking for both the English and Hawaiian names. And if you happen to see the last Gridiron show, you already have a wing up. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to give it to us gets the prize.
Aloha, I'm Chris Charbonneau from Planned Parenthood of the Great Northwest and the Hawaiian Islands. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Every 2 years, Hawaii's potters turn their attention from making bowls to asking the community to consider what goes in them. It's called the Empty Bowls Project. Potters contribute bowls by the thousands to an event aimed at providing sustenance to those in need. Attendees are offered a bowl filled with soup, a piece of bread, and an opportunity to feed a hungry soul. Tricia Beeman is a Hawaii's Potters Guild member. We spoke with her about Empty Bowls Hawaii and about the attractions of her craft.
I think for me, it's nice to be able to make something. You know, it's just nice to use your hands and to have an outlet, but especially something functional. So I really do get a lot of joy out of being able to make a bowl or a planter or something, you know, myself that I can give as a gift and other people can use.
Uh-huh. You had good teachers.
I had great teachers. Yeah, I think that's what made learning to be a potter easy. You know, I had Jeff Chang and David He and Steve Martin, all well-known potters around the island, and all of them are participating in Empty Bowl. And yeah, really having a variety of people to help guide me and show me all the tips and tricks, I think, is what helped me.
How long would it take a novice, do you think, to get started as a potter?
Well, I think it all depends on how much time you put in right away. I mean, I'm taking a class with a friend right now, and it was her first 10-week session class, and I think she's already making stuff. So, you know, she goes in and practices during the week, and It really, I think, depends on how much time you put into it. But, yeah, I think with the right guidance and persistence, you can make stuff, you know, within the first few months that you'll be happy to use.
The thing I hear from a lot of people is that there's a real physical pleasure in sort of getting your hands in and physically shaping as the wheel goes around, right?
Yeah, and it's meditative. You know, I think a lot of people say that too. I think some of, you know, what people get out of going for a jog to clear their mind is what you can have by getting on the potter's wheel.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, this community, the Potter's Guild, goes back 50 years.
Yes. So, yeah, it's our 50th anniversary. 1967 is when a group of potters here in Honolulu decided to get together and have a communal place to experience clay. That's kind of our mission, you know. And I think there was UH, there were some individual studios, but there wasn't a communal area where potters could come and work together, share all the labor that's involved in making glazes and firing, and also really launch a place that could teach others to do pottery and could be something for good, you know, really.
Yeah.
A place to do good and to help the community.
I would think, and I'm just guessing, that the whole act of the glazes would be a little bit further down the line from learning to shape the pots. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, it's easy enough when you're getting started to just, you know, dip your bowl into one different color and have a white or a brown or a blue bowl. But, you know, everyone has different strategies, has different things that they like to do with their glazing. Personally, I like throwing a lot better than glazing, but, you know, other people are different. So, yeah, it's another element. And then once you get your piece into the kiln, it's a gas kiln. So really, depending on who's firing and what parts of the kiln are hot or have reduction or oxidation, I mean, there's totally different results. So every time you make something, it's a little bit unique.
And another impression that I get, Tricia, is that there's a little bit of a random effect.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it really, depending on where in the kiln your piece is, or even what glazes the person whose piece is next to yours might have used, you can always get a different result. So that's fun for a lot of people. It can be a challenge if you want something exactly so.
Yeah.
But I think that's the beauty of having something handmade.
I think if you're too addicted to control, you might be upset at having things come out a little differently than how you expected.
Yes, that can be a challenge if you want something exactly a certain way. You have to give in a little bit to the kiln god. So.
At the same time, though, glazes are so beautiful.
Yeah, and I think that is really where you can see, you know, even different parts of the bowl might have a different sheen or a slightly different tone depending on, you know, how the firing goes. So, yeah, I mean, I think all of that adds to the handmade touch that goes into making a pot.
How far back does the Empty Bowl Project go?
So this will be the fourth time that Hawaii Potters Guild is presenting the event. It happens every other year, and it started in 2009. And in 2009, it was a much smaller event. We blocked off a block in Chinatown. We had way less pots than we have this year, and it's just grown and grown. I think part of that is because more potters are getting involved, more community organizations and schools are getting involved in making the pots, more restaurants are volunteering to make soup, and really we've also found that more and more people want to come to the event, so we've been able to grow it, which is really nice.
In your own journey to becoming a potter, how long do you think it's going to be before you can instruct?
Oh, I don't know if I ever will be able to do that. I mean, and I think it's really nice to be able to learn and, you know, take some of those learnings and be able to share them with others. And, you know, I find it really nice to be in the studio with beginning potters and at least be able to share a tip or trick.
Sure.
But, yeah, I don't know if teaching will be for me.
You see new people coming in, though?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think handmade things and ceramics in general have kind of had a resurgence, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so just there's more interest in pottery. And we find that when it's time to sign up for classes at Hawaii Potters Guild, it's like a lottery sometimes.
You really?
Know, the first day of classes, people are waiting to try and get in. And, of course, it's some returning potters or some people who just really like the teacher. But we do see interest from people who have never touched clay before or maybe did it once in high school that are just wanting to get back to the studio or heard about the studio and are wanting to take classes that are new students. So that's really nice.
And the Empty Bowl event is bigger than the previous three?
Yeah, we're making 3,000 bowls this year, so about the same as last year, but I think we're expecting a really big turnout. And it's 3,000 bowls is a lot of soup bowls, so
yes,
it's an undertaking for 2 years. We do it every other year, and pretty much once one event ends, we take a short break and then get started on making bowls again. So it's really a big effort for the guild and for other potter studios and the high schools that get involved in making the bowls.
Tricia Beeman is a member of the Hawaii Potters Guild, whose biennial Empty Bowls event will be held Friday at 6 p.m. in the Pomaikai Ballrooms at the Dole Cannery Center in Honolulu.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
One of the areas the Hawaii Community Development Authority oversees is Kaka'ako. The Honolulu District has significantly changed over the last 4 years. That has continued the battle between those who want more housing affordability rules and developers who feel hamstrung by them. A public meeting to discuss an amended rules proposal was the subject of yesterday's public meeting, but there was one problem. CivilBeat.org reporter Anita Hofschneider has today's reality check. Aloha.
Aloha, Bethan.
Good to talk to you again. Now, with this situation, everybody showed up except the HCDA board.
Yes, the room was packed with people. I had to stand in the back because so many seats were filled. But it was strange. There was only one person sitting up at the front, and it wasn't until after the meeting that I realized that he was a hearing officer whom HCDA had appointed to lead the hearing that day. But that wasn't good news to a lot of developers who have been hoping to talk to the board and to share their opinions with the board. Many of them were unhappy after the meeting.
The idea that you would only have a hearings officer there and not have people who really would be the ones responsible for internalizing a lot of the testimony and then being able to make a decision seems like it was almost a wasted meeting. Is that how people felt, that they really weren't heard?
That's exactly how people felt. I talked to one developer after the meeting who said that this is a low point for Hawaii democracy. But in HCDA's defense, the spokesman for the agency pointed out that last October, the agency's board actually approved an agenda item that said that they would use a hearing officer for this particular meeting. So if you had been at October's meeting, you would have had some public notice that this is the way the meeting would have been run. As well as, in the past, HCDA has used hearings officers for various meetings, in part because it's a volunteer board. And so, people have jobs, they are busy, and so they're not always able to make quorum.
The idea, though, that you would have to have been there at the October meeting and know that there would be a hearings officer at this one, a particularly contentious issue that just goes back and resurges all the time, seems to be something that almost, obfuscated the obvious, that the board members needed to be there, at least, enough of them prearranged to be there to hear the community concerns and certainly to hear those of the developers. And any word back why this wasn't, again, maybe put out so that people clearly had the idea that it would be the hearings officer there and not necessarily board members?
I think that HCDA was taken aback by how shocked and upset some of the attendees were that, the board wasn't there, because to their minds, this is something that they do occasionally. They just did this for a meeting on park rules in December. And some attendees, like somebody I spoke to from Habitat for Humanity, they weren't fazed because they've seen this before. But definitely developers were upset. You know, one in particular confronted an HCDA official after the hearing. And you know, when I talked to them, what they were saying was that if the board is not going to be there, they would prefer to just send in written testimony rather than taking time out of their day to come and try to make an emotional plea for why they think these rules should be changed.
I mean, the idea that everybody's time is valuable, and if the board members can't get there because their time has to be elsewhere, then that, in fairness, should be the same thing for everyone who showed up to testify to hopefully get their ear.
I'm sure that many of the developers would definitely agree with that.
So at this point, there's going to be another meeting in May on the 3rd, and a lot of people are looking toward that. Is there any indication that, in fact, the board members will be there, or are they looking to have this hearings officer again presiding?
The board members will be there. That's what I was told by HCDA's executive director. And they will again accept public testimony. But that is also a decision-making hearing, so they will listen to public testimony and then make a decision that same day. And so some developers are worried that, you know, by the time that that meeting comes along, the board members will have already made up their minds about what they're going to do and won't be swayed by any testimony they hear. But HCDA's officials say that the board members will be looking at testimony and be reviewing it in preparation for that meeting.
Okay, but you make a good point that the next meeting where they are going to be there and making a decision on the same day, what happens in the interim for everyone who has something to say, regardless of their perspective, but just to be able to make sure that it's in the hands of the board?
The hearings officer plans to write a report based on the hearing yesterday, and that will go to the board, and the board will review the, I believe it was 70 pieces of testimony that were introduced yesterday. People just have to trust, I suppose, that the board will take the time to review those testimonies or find other ways to contact them in the meantime.
That may be a lot of trust. Thanks a lot, Anita.
Thank you so much.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, today featuring reporter Anita Hochschneider.
Aloha, I'm Ai-Jen Poo, co-director of Caring Across Generations, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
As you probably remember, State House Representative Beth Fukumoto recently decided to change parties. She's saying goodbye to the GOP and hoping the Democratic Party will officially soon welcome her. This isn't the first time a politician from one party has made the switch, and it made us wonder about others in recent history who had also crossed the aisle. Former journalist and Manoa professor Gerald Kato has a long memory. We sat down this week for a history lesson.
Well, maybe I can take this a little chronologically for you. The Democrats have been in control of the legislature since 1954, continuously. And in the early years, however, the Republicans held their own. There were enough Republicans around to keep things pretty competitive. But in the 1970s, you see some Republicans bolting the party. And part of the reasons was because, if you recall, it was in the mid-70s, I believe, when Pat Robertson was running for president. And there was an ideological schism within the party. And that led early on to the departure of Donna Ikeda. You may remember Donna Ikeda, who was, she was most recently chairman of the Board of Education. Donna was a Republican. She started off as a Republican. And she and Ann Kobayashi, who's currently on the city council, were both Republicans. They left the Republican Party to become Democrats, partly because of their disagreement over the party support, or elements of the party at least supporting Pat Robertson in that election.
And what did it mean for them to be welcomed into the Democratic Party? Were they welcomed with open arms?
Oh, they were welcomed with open arms. You recall Donna Ikeda at one time was the, when she was in the state senate, was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And it hasn't hurt Ann Kobayashi's political career either. She's still in politics.
What does it mean to be welcomed into the party, though? Because when we've heard from Beth Fukumoto about her recent decision, the idea being that the party was going to have to decide to accept her, and that that might take a little while.
Well, I think there are some elements of the Democratic Party now who are a little bit leery of this idea that Republicans become Democrats. There have been quite a few recently. You may recall that, and I have to look this up myself, because in recent years, it's been quite a flow of people.
Well, even just starting from Mike Gabbard.
Mike Gabbard. Yeah. There's a good one.
In 2007, right?
Right. Mike Gabbard, who started his political career as a Republican, became a Democrat. And that was followed, if I recall, by Gil Revere, who's currently in the state Senate. He started his political career as a Republican. Aaron Ling Johansson.
That was, what, 2014? That was only a few years ago.
It was only 2 years ago. And he, by the way, Johansson was the minority leader at one time in the House. And then Beth Fukumoto. And then more recently, Alan Arakawa quietly became a Democrat. Alan Arakawa, who's the mayor of Maui, started his career as a Republican.
So clearly the point being that it's not hurting people to do that, far from it. In many ways, it seems to further the idea that we hear in quiet corners that is, if you want to get something done, you better be a Democrat.
Certainly, because the Democrats have the power. That's what politics is all about, after all. It's about having power, and the Democrats have the power right now. And if you're going to go anywhere in politics, you're going to have to be a Democrat. I think over the years, there have been a lot of talented Republicans who have come along who, because of that label alone, have prevented them from higher offices. It's just a practical matter that the label means a lot here.
But it didn't seem to mean necessarily a lot in that way with Linda Lingle. I mean, she was able to capture imagination. There were a lot of discussions of that. It was the party of Linda Lingle, not a Republican party, that she so defined it that she was able to capture the governor's office.
A lot of that was Linda Lingle. Linda Lingle was an exceptional personality, and she was able to parlay that into political success, in addition to which the Democrats were highly divided at the time she came along, and so she benefited from that.
So charisma and good timing in her case.
Charisma, good timing makes for good politics.
But once upon a time, somebody else tried that in a number of ways. I'm thinking about Frank Fossey, who also thought he had a level of charisma to be able to do that, to be able to be at one time a Republican, at one time a Democrat, and later on with the best party.
With the best party. He was everything in this town, Democrat, Republican, and an independent through the best party. But Frank Fossey was able to transcend a lot of these party labels. Much like Linda Lingle, people gravitated toward Frank Fossey because he was Frank Fossey. He was a phenomenon unto himself. Not many politicians can do that. And an illustration of that, by the way, now that you mentioned it, Beth Ann, is this. When Fossey had become a Republican, he had convinced three members of the city council. This was in the mid-'80s. He'd convinced three members of the city council, Rudy Porcaro, George Akahane, and Taraki Matsumoto, to become Republicans. At that time, the city council was a partisan body. Convinced them to become Republicans so that the Republicans would hold the majority on the city council. That resulted in a recall election. The Democrats were able to recall the three people who bolted the party and replaced them with Democrats.
So the whole thing totally backfired.
It backfired completely.
Which brings us back to what has been happening with Beth Fukumoto. Now, she said that she wanted to wait and hear from her constituents. Clearly, whatever it was that she heard convinced her that it was okay for her to switch parties. Is there anything that you see in this scenario that we should be looking at a little differently than all the ones we've talked about that happened in past?
Well, you know, she's a person who seems to have been committed to the Republican Party early on. She probably could have gone a lot further as a Democrat, but she chose to be a Republican.
And she was lauded for it.
And she got booted out of the party because she disagrees with the stance of the National Party involving President Trump. It's an unusual situation for her because she probably could have gone a lot further than she has as a Democrat, but she stuck it out with the Republicans, and then Republicans turn around and, in effect, boot her out of the party, which prompted Cynthia Thielen to say that, well, you know, there goes the future of the Republican Party. And that may well be because the Republicans need to attract people like Beth Fukumoto,
young blood.
The younger generation, younger blood, into the party if they're going to be successful into the future.
So, Jerry, one last question. If Beth Fukumoto could have gone farther as a Democrat earlier on, what about the way she may be able to go from this point forward? Because ostensibly she's the same person and she has a lot of the same ideas. Will she be able to make a difference now, or will she be in some ways diluted by the rest of the Democrats with whom she's now keeping company?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. You know, she talks in terms of trying to get together with like-minded Democrats, people of her generation for whom who share her policy goals and political goals. If she can do that, she should and could be very successful in the party. And I go back to people like Donna Ikeda, for example. As I say, Donna started off as a Republican, but once she changed parties, she was able to parlay that party label into becoming head of the Ways and Means Committee, which is the most powerful committee in the state Senate.
Well, we'll see what happens with Beth Fukumoto. Certainly the pronouncements of what may happen and a look at the past. If past is prologue, who knows what may happen at this point. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Gerald Kato is an associate professor of journalism at the University of Hawaii Manoa. Before joining the faculty, he spent 20 years working in print and broadcast journalism.
Aloha, this is Joey Manahan. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we told you about Hawaii's only native land mammal, a bat that feeds on insects at twilight, homing in on its prey through echolocation. It's believed to be a fairly recent arrival to the islands. Scientists have concluded from genetic material that this flying mammal colonized the islands about 10,000 years ago, with a second colonization as recently as 800 years ago. It's nocturnal, like all bats, but it doesn't roost in caves like so many other bat species. It does sleep upside down, hanging from the branches of trees, but does so alone, also unlike most other bats. It locates its prey through echolocation, sending out high-pitched vocalizations that bounce back and allow it to pinpoint the location of its prey. Because it's such an agile flyer, a brief audio signal is all it needs to send a hapless insect to its doom. Its Hawaiian name, Opeapea, is based on its resemblance to a taro leaf. Its English name, the Hawaiian hoary bat, is said to describe the frosty or hoary appearance of its brown and white fur.
And Amy Hallis called us from Kahului, Maui, knew the answer, as did many people. The phone lines were really lighting up. Lots of folks from all through across Hawaii had the answer, including a high school biology teacher who's planning to teach this to her Big Island students very soon. But Amy was first. She gets the prize. Now, if you've got a backyard quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com.
Creative communities, in an unfortunate reflection of society at large, don't always open their doors to people with disabilities. A theater performance in Hilo next weekend, based on a children's book called Fuzzy Land, is aimed at righting an imbalance. It's a collaboration between the New Alchemists, Full Life Hawaii, and Abled Hawaii Artists. Lily Robb is the artistic director at the New Alchemists, and she's on the line from Hilo. What got this project going?
Well, the New Alchemists are a theater-making collective. We have members in Seattle, Los Angeles, and New York City. And part of that was that we wanted to be able to do really wonderful, socially progressive work in non-traditional communities anywhere in the country that was willing to have us and that had a community who needed to have a platform.
Well, you found one, didn't you?
We did, here in Hilo, which is a wonderful community to be a part of, as our artistic producer, Brandon Estrella, was born and raised here. And last year, he approached the rest of the team and said that we had this incredible opportunity to be part of First Fridays, which lit us up, and we wanted to know more. And Brandon has just done an incredible job of organizing within the community, which is how we got connected with Full Life and Abled Hawaii. And so far, we've been... I think we've done 3 workshops now, and it's been an incredible community to be a part of. They're really, you can feel the joy in the room. The first workshop, we were invited to come and be part of a dance class beforehand, and it was so fun, so much laughter, so much joy, so much incredible participation, and everyone has been so willing to jump in and throw themselves into the creation process. So very excited for our performance coming up.
Well, Lily, I suspect part of the joy that you felt in the room comes from the idea that projects like this don't happen often enough. Would you agree with that?
Projects like this do not happen enough. A lot of that has to do with the way that traditional theater is made. Typically, theater is made by an institution that, in sort of an insular bubble, decides what the community needs. They just make those decisions for the community without necessarily looping them in. And the New Alchemists, are the core of our mission is to go into the community first and ask them what's relevant, what's resonating, what's important, and then from that, allow them to guide us to create the work, which is why when we contacted Full Life, we were given this opportunity to adapt a play based on Fuzzy Land, which is written by one of their participants, Jennifer Poblano, who's been receiving employment services from Full Life for 2 years. And actually, she's working on her second novel now. So, you know, there might also be a sequel. But this opportunity to take her story and to adapt it and then to give it this platform at the East Hawaii Cultural Center, I think is really special. It's innovative. And as you said, it doesn't happen very often.
And, you know, when you describe your mission at the New Alchemists, I really think you're on to something, because there's a bit of an unfortunate tradition in the arts of, you know, I'm going to separate myself from society and its problems and just, you know, make my pretty pictures or whatever. And that's really abdicating a bit of the responsibility of the artist, it would seem.
I personally believe that. For me, as an artist, I strongly believe that art should be relevant to the community that you are in. It should make a statement about the state of the world. It should resonate with the cultural zeitgeist. Those are just my personal core values. I think that good theater should be equitable and diverse. It should lift up voices that we do not hear often enough. I think that there is an oversaturation of a certain kind of narrative in mainstream theater, and we never really get to break outside of that. And so projects like what we're doing with Full Life do get to break that. I also think that theater should be built with the community, inside of the community, and for the community, allowing them to guide you. I think that theater should be transformative. Ideally, we are going to shake up audience members one performance at a time and hopefully let them think a little bit differently about the community or the issues that we're addressing when they leave the theater. It's also extremely important to me that the theater itself be experiential and not just focus on the product, but also focus on the process, how we build an ensemble, how we build a community, and then how that translates into the performance and how we engage the audience and enter into a conversation and a dialogue with them.
Lily, I want to seize on a phrase you used, an oversaturation of a certain type of narrative. And let me just make a guess as to what you might be thinking that is. Are you talking about, you know, pretty perfect people and idealized lives?
I'm talking about pretty perfect people and idealized lives, and I will actually even go farther than that to say, as someone who works in professional theaters and helps to produce, that we often see an oversaturation of white, cisgender, male perspectives. There are so many white male playwrights, and they are predominantly produced. And it is rare for us to get female perspectives, to get LGBTQ perspectives, to get people of color perspectives, to get the perspectives of people with disabilities. These are not folks that are being represented often enough in mainstream institutions. And so for me as an artist, I simply do not want to continue to maintain that narrative. I want to break it down. And I also want to show how absolutely incredible these communities are, the sheer talent, the stories, the narratives. I strongly believe that institutions are actually weakened by the exclusion of these stories, and that as institutions, we have so much to gain by the inclusion. And having Full Life be able to join us in this project is incredible. And then having a platform like East Hawaii Cultural Center in downtown Hilo give us a space and access to their resources and their community gives us an incredible platform to share this story.
Well, maybe the idealized anguish of the white male bourgeoisie has finally had its day, Lily. Let's hope so. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Chris.
Lily Robb is the artistic director at The New Alchemist, which, along with Full Life Hawaii and Abled Hawaii Artists, will produce a 30-minute original stage performance inspired by author Jennifer Poblano's Fuzzy Land, a children's book. It's on Friday, April 7th, and again on Saturday afternoon at the East Hawaii Cultural Center in downtown Hilo.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting ukulele artist Jake Shimabukuro on stage in two sets nightly, April 3rd through the 5th. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Each day provides us with a new slate of activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us at this point in our show to look at events going on in our community that might be under the radar, and mostly on the Big Island under the radar today.
Yes, Derek. In fact, they are all on the Big Island. There is an all-day festival tomorrow focusing on East Hawaii's Micronesian community. It's called the Hilo Craft Fair and Cultural Festival, and it's happening in Sangha Hall from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. You can buy crafts and other cultural handiworks made in East Hawaii by the Micronesian community. Entry is free for the fair. That's from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. But after that, there's a music and dance festival from 3 to 9 p.m., and performers from East Hawaii's Micronesian communities will showcase traditional and modern styles. There is a small fee for that, so that's an all-day affair.
And that's East Hawaii, and then in West Hawaii, there's also something going on.
Yes, people in West Hawaii can speak directly with their state and West Hawaii County representatives. It's happening tomorrow in the West Hawaii Civic Center from 6 to 8 p.m., and it's free. You can share your thoughts on the issues and priorities for Hawaii that's important to you, your family, and the community. Senators Josh Green and Lorraine Inouye will be there, along with representatives Richard Cregan, Nicole Lowen, and Cindy Evans. For more details, go to westhawaiiforum.org.
Keeping alive the tradition of the town meeting, Derek.
Yeah.
And here's a workshop for those of us whose lives are without purpose.
You can learn how to live happy and with a purpose, Chris, and the rest of us, too. Register and attend a free interactive purpose workshop to discover or rediscover your gifts, passion, and values. This workshop will be held at Volcano Arts Center in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park. It's free from 5:30 to 7:30, but you do need to RSVP. Find out more on our website and follow your bliss.
I'm on my way. Thanks, Derek.
Sure, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that are going on under the radar. And you can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, what does it take to pursue something that everyone else thinks is nuts?
He was ostracized and isolated.
You know, there were people who called him a great American humorist within the profession.
Outsiders by design. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Sunday morning at 11.
And that takes us to the end of today's show. Coming up tomorrow, Town Square. We'll be talking about Equal Pay Day. Susan Wurzburg, the policy chair for AAUW Hawaii, will be here. Kathy Betts, the executive director of the Hawaii State Commission on the Status of Women. And Colin Moore, the director of the Public Policy Center at UH. We'll all be around the table. We'll hope you'll plan to join us tomorrow at 11 and 7.
And as always, we like to hear from you. You can call our talk back line and leave your comments at this phone number, 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR.
And if you want anything else, just check out the archive. You can find it at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you tomorrow for Town Square, right here